interface.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, so Ming, did you get a chance to read that
paper?
Yeah,
actually, I've read pretty much it.
Yeah. It's Karsten Schwann's student, right? The first guy?
I sounds familiar, but you're busy, right? Karsten is not involved in this paper.
No, he's not. Because I think his PhD student graduated and went to Microsoft Research.
Yeah. Well, I think the underlying approach is similar to the HP paper.
Control theory.
They're controlling the,
The allocation.
The allocation, right, with the target of compensating the interference. Actually, the control model is exactly the same, it's just the input and output are different. Actually, the output is the same, the input are different.
So in the HP case, the input was utilization, or?
Yeah, in the HP case, I think.
Utilization and path allocation.
But in the native one, the calculation yours is online. They also use the MIMO control model.
No, but that's the same model they use. It's path allocation plus past performance is an input, and output is future allocation and future performance.
Right, but in this one, it's not a past allocation of a single virtual machine. It's the past allocation for all the concurrent virtual machines. That's how you take the interference into consideration, because all the current virtual machines past history affect all of their future performance. So then the interference is inherently captured there. But in the HP papers, they use a single virtual machine's past history and allocation to predict that single virtual machine's future
performance.
Right. So there's no interference captured in that model.
No, they model it individually.
Right, but in the other MIMO models, they capture the contention. So if there are contention on the single resource, and if you want to optimize it, they use an MIMO model for that. Okay, so there's a difference, a subtle difference there. Because HP paper does not really capture the interference in their model, that's why this paper can get published. They are all in UN.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Ajay.
This is Ajay.
No problem. No problem at all. Sajib and Ming are here with me, and Kaushik might be running late, it seems, but we could get started, and Kaushik might join us at some point. Okay. So
hi, Ajay. So you saw my email last night?
Yeah, I saw your email.
So pretty much that's my progress so far.
Oh, okay. So we are still struggling with OLTP.
Yeah, I got good performance with the CPU benchmark, but the OLTP is, it's more complex because you have interdependency with all the parameters, and mostly it's nonlinear, so it's taking a longer time to model or to get a desired accuracy.
I see. Okay. And have we tried using any other modeling parameters than what we had in the paper? For example, are we taking measurements on latency or other metrics?
No, because right now I don't have those data in my collection.
Oh, okay. Because I almost feel that if the part of the problem is that we are not collecting enough metrics, and maybe the metrics that we are collecting are not enough, then even if we have more data points, it may not give us the best accuracy. So, ideally, we should collect more statistics, and then we should say these are the principal components, and then prune out things that don't have enough correlation with the output. And here we seem to be making a judgment call up front. That was my opinion.
I think that's a very good point, Ajay. And in the HPCA paper, we did talk about some potential additional parameters that we could introduce into the model that could help, for instance, capture cache contention. Because I think that's you know, especially if you look at the QClouds paper, they seem to you know, give substantial importance to that. Their focus, of course, is CPU intensive workloads, where this really matters a lot, I guess. But even in our case, I would expect for some applications, cache contention can substantially affect performance. Yeah, the issue though is it's hard to measure cache contention.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing is that we should collect more stats and then we can figure out which one are good enough in terms of doing the prediction. And second, I think on QCloud's paper, I think again they are doing just CPU. And if you look at just CPU, there are many publications that exist before. HP has done CPU modeling in past, and they seem to indicate that it's easier to model the CPU. And actually, HP's paper from Shayan, Pradeep, Sharad Singhal, there is a group that does control theory in HP.
Mm-hmm.
And they also used a similar MIMO control.
Yeah, I read this paper.
Go back and see what is different in this paper that wasn't done in HP's paper. I think other than the fact that they have modeled the problem as a cloud problem, and in HP's paper it was just a virtualization problem that you are running VMs and how do you guarantee performance in presence of CPU contention. I think I didn't see very much new.
Yeah, I think we were just talking about this, you know, comparison with the HP work before you called in.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know where we were at in that discussion.
I think
Ming
has a point. I think Ming was saying that in the HP's paper, the model actually takes into account, only takes single VM into account. They don't actually incorporate competition, as far as I remember, I'm not sure. Or the contention. But in the QCloud, they actually talk about the contention.
But the question is, how do they model contention? I think they model contention because the input parameters that affect a specific VM's performance include the allocations of all the other VMs as well, right? So it's not just the allocation of that specific VM that affects the output of the VM. But it's the allocation of all the other VMs that are running simultaneously alongside this VM. Now, those parameters will perhaps capture the effect of cache contention and other contentions introduced because of these competing VMs.
Yeah.
So.
And in this case, I mean, if you are running at one VM per core, you mentioned in the Eurosys paper, QClouds, they are running one VM per core.
I'm not sure that is.
No?
And if they are running one VM per core, then even if there is cache contention, how will they give more resources to that VM?
Yeah,
I don't think it's one virtual machine in one core. Actually, they mentioned like 50% of a core is a virtual machine somewhere. I think it's more faster than that.
I mean, they have to keep headroom. They have to run multiple VMs per core so that they can say that now we'll give more CPU because there is contention.
I read this in the evaluation section.
Or maybe the evaluation is simpler, but
4.2. Now maybe their design does not really need to be restricted that way. But
no, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, it could be that even if we relax the restriction, their work still applies. So if you have one VM per core, the contention will still be on the shared cache, right?
Yeah.
True, but how will they resolve that contention? I mean, what would be the resolution to help the VM?
You cannot change the CPU allocation.
No, you can change the CPU allocation of the other VMs. So the cache contention due to other VMs reduces.
Yeah. Because if you load, then you only have one core, how do you change it?
No, it's per core, right? All VMs have per core.
No, but you're talking about if you dedicate one core to the virtual machine, right?
What did you mean? Do you mean that each virtual machine has one core?
Yeah. If we assume that each VM has one core, you still have contention.
Where do you move the VMs around? Because no matter where you put it, it will still be sharing the last level cache.
It will be, but the rate of flooding of that cache will depend on the CPU that's allocated to that competing VM. Right? So if you reduce the allocation for that, if you cap the competing VM, then the cache will be flooded less because of that VM. I think that's the assumption they're going under.
I mean, to tell you the truth, a real implementable solution to this problem has to be that the caches have to be QoS aware. I don't know if you have seen, there have been some papers from Intel where they're trying to put QoS awareness in caches. And I think until and unless they build a cache which can, where you can set controls and get QoS, it's going to be very hard to just moving VMs around or restricting their CPUs to handle cache contention that way. That seems like a very indirect way of controlling something.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, it's certainly indirect, but I think the QClouds folks are arguing that's given the current state of the art of commodity, cheap, or affordable hardware, really you don't have a way to directly and dynamically allocate cache resources.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the real cloud scenarios that they are going after, there are so many issues in terms of contention that I think caching is just one part of the whole puzzle.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
I mean, this is just saying that this is a high-level problem and we would scratch one corner and we are trying to resolve that corner with this module, and there are other 20 things existing which can lead to performance differentiation.
Yeah, certainly the paper could have been more, I guess, accepting of the fact that this is not a complete solution, right? Maybe they do talk about it in future work. I don't know. I didn't read the conclusions. I just stopped
there at this. Huge conclusions in future work. Much more than a full column.
Did you imagine cache interference is just one type of interference? There's also interference like I/O and the memory bandwidth, right? So we are considering I/O. They are focusing on cache interference.
Yeah.
I feel their approach is generally not to be applicable to other interference.
Well, I think they are considering memory bandwidth interference also, because memory bandwidth interference can once again be...
Thanks.
You're welcome. Let me conference in Ajay as well. Ajay, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, so, yeah. I lost where we were.
Conclusion.
About
the general applicability of this approach. I think it's generally done.
Yeah.
For different types of interference.
They're
mainly focusing on the cache interference in this case.
Right.
They're only focusing on the CPU intensive workloads.
Yeah. So Kaushik, we are discussing the QClouds paper right now. Okay, so, so the other question I had, I guess, for Ajay, you might know more about this, which is the assumption of a core per VM. Does that make sense, or?
So definitely for internal cloud, the consolidation is much more than that. I don't think our customers dedicate one core per cloud, and for VDI developments, I think the ratio is as far as 6 to 8 VMs per core.
Oh.
But I can imagine, I think Amazon EC2, they actually try to give dedicated resources in terms of virtual to physical mapping.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask for 4GB memory, they'll give you 4GB physical memory. And there, they might be giving you a full core.
Mm.
And
that's where they
derived it from.
Yeah, I'll give you my perspective from the customer perspective, because I'm using a cloud for some of my consulting budget and etc. And there is basically based on the pricing. So if you pay higher price, you can get a dedicated one. If you want to pay the low, if you are the lower end of pricing, then you don't get the dedicated one.
No, but then do they specify if you are paying, let's say, 20% less price, are they putting two of them on one core or are they putting five VMs on one core?
They don't specify, but they specifically say that you are not, this code is not dedicated to you. They don't explicitly say that and how many
clients per
core.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think Amazon also has a similar
but
I wouldn't worry too much about them making that assumption. Maybe in environments where they are selling VMs, it makes sense to have that assumption. But, I mean, my main concern, one of the concerns that we didn't discuss yet about the paper, some of the scenarios that they are putting out are very hard to achieve. For example, doing pricing based on application performance and charging less money if your application performance don't add up, I think it's a very hard goal to achieve because the fact that the application is not getting enough could be because of so many reasons that no CSP would like to lose revenue in this case. Because application level metrics are very obscure and complicated. For example, transactions per second. That depends a lot on how many transactions you are actually running. And given the same amount of underlying resources, the number of output transactions can vary drastically. So that was another thing in the paper that I found that not very easy to get, and they basically seem to say that with their kind of approach, one can go towards it.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I remember reading somewhere where they talk about, at least for their experiments, that they map each VM to a core. I'm having a hard time finding it right now, but I thought I saw it somewhere. Maybe someone else saw it too.
No, that's fine. I mean, I think even if they mentioned it, that's fine. It doesn't change it much.
Okay, so, so I guess the other key difference is the focus on the CPU intensive workloads for both their design as well as evaluation, right? And the paper talks about using a linear model as an approximation for capturing the influence of the allocation parameters, right, on performance. And they had one example of a workload where it was not the case, where they required a second degree polynomial, right, to actually capture the impact of CPU cap. So there are two parts of this, right? The first part is, how do you model interference and account for interference in doing the right allocation to achieve the basic SLA requirements, right? And then if there is headroom for allocating more CPU, how do you allocate such over-provisioned CPU so that you do not violate the basic SLA for any VM, but perhaps achieve higher levels of SLA for some VMs. Right. So this is sort of their pricing model that they're assuming, that each VM will have multiple SLA points where they are willing to pay an increased amount of money. Yeah, so it seems like, Ajay, what you're saying about this differentiated pricing and multiple price points, you think that's something not done in practice, or you think that won't be the way the industry would move forward in the future, or?
I mean, the way pricing is done is more like they would give you 3 or 4 different fixed prices, and they would say this is a gold standard, this is a silver standard, and this is some bronze standard. And now you can pick either one. And the fact that in case of gold and silver, the allocation they are making in the back end is, let's say they are setting your shares to be 1:2 ratio. Or they are dedicating a core to you versus they are putting 4 VMs on one core. I think those things, as of now, they are completely hidden from the customer. All you see is that either you are going to see good performance or better performance or really great performance. And there is no quantitative numbers associated with them.
I see.
And I think that's what most of the CSPs have today.
I see. And so I guess your point is that the customer has to sort of try out if bronze is good enough for them or not, because they will probably pay for the bronze first, and then if that's not good enough, they'll have to upgrade to a silver, and if that's not good enough, they'll have to upgrade for a gold.
Yeah. Can I comment?
Yeah, sure.
Yes and no, really. That's the situation when customer is renting a machine, physical machine. Physical means not the physical machine, but the virtual machine or whatever it is. From the customer point, is that they're getting a machine, and the customer is using the machine in whatever way they want. Well, that's one way. That's one way that it is being used. There are other kinds of data center where they don't say that they don't do the contract on the machine level. They do the contract on the application level. So in those cases, the complete application running, maintenance running is given to the data center, and in those cases the data center contract is based on the application metrics.
So it's more like appliances.
I think we are talking two different things. If you are talking about getting the Amazon kind of pricing, where you get Amazon kind of pricing or Rackspace pricing or even the GoDaddy kind of pricing, then you're talking about different things. Okay, you're getting a machine and you use the machine to do whatever you want, really. I don't think we're talking about that kind of scenario in this particular paper. We are talking about where the application is being deployed, and the application maintenance is the responsibility of the data center. And the customer doesn't know that whether the application is being installed in 2 virtual machine or 3 virtual machine or whatever. The only SLA, only contract they have is, okay, I need this much of the revenue, I need this much of the transaction per second, or this has to be the average throughput, those kind of SLA they provide.
I think that is sort of drawing the distinction between what they say infrastructure as a service versus platform as a service. For example, I think Salesforce.com is a very typical example that gives you the CRM application, and they host the full application for you. And they would maintain all the hardware that is required to run the app. They would maintain the databases that are hosting all the data, and they'll give you a certain response time in terms of using that app.
So platform or infrastructure as a service?
That is platform. Actually, Salesforce is almost software as a service. Because they're giving you a software application as a full service.
Yeah.
And infrastructure is what Amazon gives.
Okay. Infrastructure is where you rent a virtual machine and you put whatever you want in it and do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess these are two distinct models. I don't know which model.
I don't think we are going for the infrastructure model, because in case of infrastructure, the customer is buying the machine, and the machine happens to be the virtual machine. That's a different. The machine is coming from the cloud. That's a different scenario. But what kind of application is running or what kind of allocation is being done, there is no control to the customer on that. I think we're talking about the second. Salesforce automation is not the right, it's kind of a thing, but it's not the right one, because Salesforce is almost like a software as a service, like a Google or Microsoft or email kind of service. Really. It's almost like that. Really. But there are certain services where it is possible that, okay, I take the responsibility of running the application.
But what would be an example of that? if it's not Salesforce?
I'm trying to think of it. I know it is pretty much used very much on the internally. Really. Like say for example, yeah. when you're going for a big finance company like JP Morgan, Mellon, these kind of companies, their data center run as a almost like independent data center, and they charge back to each and individual unit basically. And each of individual units that the SLA contract they have with the data center is based on the application metrics, and the responsibility of the running those applications falls on the data center.
I see. I think based on the model that you just explained, it seems like it's a cloud model where there is infrastructure being given, but it's an internal cloud. So if you have a data center in which JP Morgan is running multiple applications and they go and they say, our finance app requires this much SLA, and that finance app is being hosted by 100 VMs, then each VM would have dedicated resource controls in terms of how much CPU, memory, I/O the VM is supposed to get. And it seems like the goal is to figure out what should those controls be so that the application gets the performance that it needs.
Exactly.
So I think in that case, we are closer to the infrastructure as a service. It's just that I think the use case that you mentioned is more of an internal cloud or private cloud, what we call, and not a public cloud. But ultimately what we are doing is massaging controls on the VMs.
Yeah. And some of the public cloud is coming up, I know. So for example, Rackspace is, I know, that is trying to come up with that kind of model. Really.
As a platform,
I believe that Teradata is also trying to come up with a similar kind of model, cloud model.
So where is the guarantees on application performance?
Yeah, it's more of the application performance. Because when you're giving the machine, then the responsibility of maintaining those machines falls on the customer. Really. And now some people are trying to get away from that. You just develop the things that you give up, because that's also a headache, maintaining the machine itself. They configure the machine, because once you get the machine, you have, say for example, you're running a WebLogic or WebSphere, then how much JVM, how much memory you will give it to JVM, what is the configuration of the JVM, those things you need to configure early.
Yeah.
So some people are trying to get out away from that. So there is a market for where you just get the application and you run on the application level, early, on the application metrics.
So it seems like if that's the motivation for the work and that's what we are targeting, then from the QCloud's paper scenarios, we are actually going after either scenario 2 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, we are more likely going towards 4, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. 4. Yeah.
And we are basically saying that we are going after 4 and we are going to control multiple resources instead of just CPU. And I think the controls that are at a higher level instead of trying to do very fine-grained CPU cache contention management.
Yeah.
Which seems reasonable, because I think trying to do cache contention level management is a very fine-grained knob which doesn't even exist properly in most systems right now.
Yeah.
And these guys also, they are doing CPU cache in order to really make sure that you are getting the SLA.
Yeah. And I think QCloud also, they are assuming scenario 4, right? Which is this platform or software as a service model, where the guarantees are on application performance and the pricing is also on application performance. And here, yeah.
I think platform as a service, the term that I mentioned, that is what people use to talk about Google and Microsoft Azure, where they give you the platform and then you write the application in the languages that they specify, and then you run it on their platform. But you don't get a machine. You basically write the app in the language that they give you, and then they would just run the app on their platform.
Yeah, that's a good example, actually, yes.
So, I mean, I think that is a separate model that we are not.
So, there are two types of models. One is the Amazon model and there is the Microsoft Azure model.
Yeah.
Microsoft what model?
Azure.
Azure, that's the Microsoft offering to compete with Google.
I see. Also, the Apple iPhone model? Is that
Limited.
Also? Does the Apple iPhone app and whatever, does that also fall into the same category?
No.
I mean, in that case, the app is running on your phone. They are just providing a marketplace.
I see. Okay.
Apple is just in business of making money. They just take the cut for selling the app for you.
So they're not running anything on their data centers?
No, in most cases not. I mean, what they run is the App Store, and then they handle everything that is required to running the App Store. And in some cases, apps require back-end computing, but that computing is happening on the application writer's data center. So if the app is Google Maps, then it's running on Google's data center.
I see. Okay.
Not on Apple.
Seems like Apple can make more money if they did this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a well-known thing to say Apple has as good marketing as the technical people that they have.
Yeah, maybe better marketing than, well, I don't know, I shouldn't comment on that. They're really smart engineers, too.
True. I mean, they dare to say that both the departments are equally competitive.
Mm.
Because if any one of them lags, it's not a good thing.
I see. Yeah. Okay, so I guess what, I mean, this discussion is sort of helping us sharpen our message in terms of motivation and context. What we are basically talking about is rather than infrastructure as a service, for which you probably need very different kinds of provisioning, maybe more fine-grained, here we are talking about application as a service where the guarantees and pricing are on application performance, and the management of the virtual hardware as well as the application is sort of left to the data center, and this is seems like a solution for that a data center operator would use, right, in such a model.
Or internal clouds would use.
Or even
companies who are running private clouds, they would use to figure out how to best provision their VMs, because otherwise the current state of the art is, if you are JP Morgan or if you are Goldman Sachs, then you would have a data center and they would run their apps. In order to provide a certain guarantee, every app would be over provisioned.
Yeah.
And that's the typical setting. They would say, let's look at if there is any ready time on the CPU. And they would make sure to give enough CPU to make ready time equal to zero.
Mm.
And same thing, they would look at the swap space usage and they would say, let's make it zero. But the fact is that you don't need to have zero ready time to get a certain application level SLA. You might be getting the SLA that you need even with 20% ready time.
Yeah.
But that is something that they don't know that, but value is good enough. So aiming for zero is probably the easiest thing to do.
Hmm. Right. That's certainly, was a useful discussion. So, I was wondering if, in our case, if we were to use the competing VM CPU allocation as input parameters, does it capture I/O contention as well? Because I/O contention, isn't it sort of dependent on how much CPU you give to the contending VM?
No, not really. Because into the other VMs, right?
Yeah.
No, not really. Because right now, how I'm modeling is just I'm fixing the domain, the domain which is issuing the competing I/O,
mm-hmm.
So fixing the cap of it. So even with fixing the cap of it, even with keeping the other virtual machine's cap same, you could increase the I/O contention and reduce the application performance. It's not really dependent on gap only.
No, but what I'm saying is that if we go with the kind of solution that these guys are proposing, the QCloud guys, which is you want to sort of model application performance in a dynamic fashion, and you want to model it based on the set of VMs that are running on the same hardware, sharing the same resources, including I/O, and things like cache and memory and so on, memory bandwidth, then maybe the contention can be modeled using the allocation values of the competing VMs, because the competing VMs has stable behavior in terms of I/O. Say, okay, at 20% CPU allocation, 20% of a core, let's say, that VM is going to generate 100 I/O ops. But at 50%, it's going to generate 1,000 I/O ops. So can I model contention the way they are thinking, they have been modeling contention? So I know that they don't claim they model I/O, but I'm trying to think if why you can't take it that, you know, to that step as well and include I/O using the same technique.
I think it depends on the application. If for a OLTP like workload, for example, when we run Swing Bench or other DS2, which is the DVD store workload, it takes enough CPU and it produces a lot of I/O. In that case, if you reduce CPU, the I/Os would get reduced, because in query processing, once it fetches I/Os, it actually does a lot of computation before issuing the other one.
Right.
But there are other I/O workloads possible which actually don't do much number crunching. They just produce a lot of I/Os.
Mm.
And in that case, you can change the CPU to within a wide range, and the I/Os may not get affected as much.
I see.
I mean, a very canonical example is if you're doing a big copy, or if you're doing a big batch virus. Actually, virus scanner still does some computation. But if you're doing any kind of workload movement where you're copying some stuff out, there is no CPU to be performed.
Right.
It's just barely taking interrupts and sending data in and out.
That's a good point. I guess the QClouds paper, the reason the competing CPU allocations work is because CPU allocation does control cache contention in a direct way,
mm-hmm.
right? And plus they are looking at CPU intensive workloads, right? So that also helps them quite a bit.
Yeah, I think for them CPU is a hammer and they are looking for nails.
Hmm.
And I think they are not going to find too many nails, because it's very hard to control I/O allocation or memory allocation just based on CPU.
Yeah.
And even if they try to make the case it would work for the particular app they are going to choose, but it won't be a generic solution.
Yeah. So in our case, since we look at the competing I/O directly and use it directly, it's instead of using a CPU allocation as an indirect metric, I think we'll do okay. In terms of modeling the I/O contention.
Exactly. I mean, we have a knob that I/O nice value, which means you can change the I/O nice value to help in application in terms of I/O scheduling at least.
Yeah, that's true. So that does help control the amount of I/O.
It's sort of correlated. I mean, if you prioritize, let's say you're targeting one virtual machine, you give it higher priority, the issuing I/O request from other domains gets reduced.
Mm-hmm.
The I/O, so the competing I/O gets reduced. And if you give lower priority to the target virtual machine, the competing I/O gets increased.
Mm-hmm.
But the QCloud people can also do that, right? They can also control I/O.
Yeah.
I mean, they can try to extend their model. It's not quite clear if their MIMO control module is going to be able to figure out all the dependencies between different resources.
Yeah. The thing is that IO Nice is only doing a relative priority.
across being a hard allocation.
Yeah,
but CAP is sort of hard allocation.
CAP is a hard allocation, but also in case of IO, it could be that the other VMs are not doing any IO at all, or they are doing a lot of IO, and that's not being captured in the IONICE control.
No, that's why we needed a fourth parameter.
Yeah. So it really, I mean, IONICE does not is not telling you all the information. Or
Zen doesn't have a IO limit parameter. Can you limit the number of IO ops from a VM, like a CAP?
No.
There is, I think Ming talked about DM band at some point, which I don't know if that can be used with Zen.
Yes.
It can be?
Yes.
So there, the what DM band allows you to do is to
you can control the bandwidth, the bytes per second. You control the actual IO bandwidth to each virtual machine.
So it's more like bytes per second rather than IO ops, because if you do bytes per second, then there's going to be a huge difference between sequential versus random. I mean, similarly for IOPS, right? I mean, these two independently do not tell you about the amount of disk utilization.
Right, right. So you can only give you a cap, but it cannot help you to reach the maximum utilization.
True. I think if they do bytes per second, that is still fine as the first cut. What we can do is, I think sequential versus random, we don't have to worry too much about, because most workloads turn out to be random. And things that are going to the LUN specially, since there would be 50 VMs running on one LUN, it's not going to see much sequentiality. Right. I think as long as the IO sizes are not very different. So let's say you know that one VM does 8K IO size, other VM does 16K. In that case, one can use that information to convert bytes per second into IOPS, or IOPS into bytes per second. So I think it is still a useful control if it's there.
So yeah, I think it is there. We haven't yet used it for this work. I mean, if we switch to that, then we need to collect new data. Or
that's the modeling will also change.
The modeling might change, but it's in some sense it's a more direct control than IONICE plus the competing IOPS.
You need only IO controller and memory and CPU, three parameters.
But as I said, that the limitation is you don't know what is the maximum bandwidth. So you can only allocate IO bandwidth conservatively. If you don't want to overbook your IO bandwidth, but you may have extra, because the IO patterns are different. Maybe all sequential IOs can reach higher, but that would be
I think Ajay is arguing that, I mean, if you look at a virtualized environment with network attached storage, then your IOs are going to be end up being random. But I think Ajay, there is a caveat there. It really depends on the IO rates, right? For instance, if I have a VM that's doing sequential IO, and then I have a VM that's doing random IO. Now, depending on how quickly they're issuing those IOs, that sequential performance is going to degrade by different amounts, right? So if the random IO is 1 per second, then there'll probably be no effect on the sequential performance. On the other hand, if the random IO is, 1 per millisecond, then that can substantially impact the sequential performance.
True, but I think if the random IO is 1 per second, then even in your case, you are not going to see some impact. I mean, you are not doing anything to hurt the sequential workload intentionally. It's just that you are not preserving it. And typically, there is some batching that happens anyways. For example, in ESX, we try to batch IO requests from the same VM. So let's say you are issuing IOs from VM1. Then it would try to issue a small number of IOs from that VM. You can set that number to be 8 or 4 or 16. And then it would send that many IOs before it will switch to VM2. So in that sense, some amount of sequentiality or even locality is preserved.
Zen does that too.
Zen does that too. But I mean, this would apply if there was only one host. and one ESX, right? But if you have multiple ESX all talking to the same SAN, then you would still have that interference.
Yeah. True. It's, I mean, the only way to avoid the interference is you have multiple ESX hosts, all of them would send a certain number of requests to the array. And now the array queue would have overall 200 requests sitting in it.
Right.
And then within the array queue, it would run the elevator scan.
Right.
So if there are 8 sequential requests sitting in that queue, the array would service them sequentially.
Hmm.
I mean, the thing that we can do in the hypervisor layer is to make sure that if we see sequentiality coming in, we try to send it to the array, and everybody else would send it to the array, and then let's see how good a job the array does.
Yeah.
Because we cannot keep one request at a time at the array. We have to keep a large number. Typically, the LUNs are with 10, 15 disks anyways.
Right. And I guess you can do that if you have asynchronous requests coming in from each VM. But if they're synchronous, then you have to send it out before you're going to get the next one. Or you have to respond to that before you get the next one.
True. I mean, if the VM is doing one IO at a time, then that is true.
Yeah.
But most VMs, they assume that they have a disk underneath that can handle multiple IOs at a time.
Right.
For example, when we run some OLTP workload in the VM, the OLTP workload knows that the device underneath would benefit from more IOs, and it keeps 16 or some number of outstanding IOs on the device. And we basically see those 16 IOs coming out from the VM.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because most of these applications, they are designed to keep multiple. For example, web server. A web server would never keep one outstanding IO.
Hmm.
It would use a bunch of threads to keep multiple outstanding IOs at the same time.
Right.
So, but you're right. If an application keeps one, then there is nothing we can do. That's a choice the application is making. And in that case, the sequentiality in the application is very likely gone. I mean, by the time the second request comes, the head would be somewhere else that application has no control over.
Yeah. I think what helps the sequentiality a bit is that kernels do prefetching if it's a read stream, right? So even if the rate at which the request is coming in is small, you will see bunches of or batches of sequential accesses because of the prefetch mechanism.
True.
Yeah.
So that also helps. Yeah.
Mm.
It's just that, I mean, most of these things, they are sort of, it's just hard to guarantee these things. They happen and they lead to better performance.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say that we would preserve some sequentiality to 80% or some number.
Right. Okay. So, I think this was quite a useful discussion. I think we should probably talk about the next steps for the paper, right? So, Sajib, what in terms of modeling, I think we started a discussion over email about automating this thing.
This thing is hard, actually, because unless you know how the application behaves with the input parameters, you can't really pinpoint to what needs to be done in terms of the training. I mean, what points need to be included or what points need to be discarded.
Okay, we wrote an algorithm in the
HPP
paper.
That's sort of vague.
Really?
I mean, it's nice to read, but when you try to look at this and try to figure out this, it's hard, actually.
I don't think so. I think the algorithm was fairly specific in what it did, right? And we actually came up with the algorithm based on how you described to me the manual training process that you were using, and we came up with an automation description for that, right?
Yeah.
So I think our next step, I mean, it seems like if you are doing this manually, you'll waste a lot of time.
I think it's overnight.
It's not just about getting the data, because
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you run the experiments, you collect the data, you can go to sleep. But if you're creating the model manually, testing one, input one testing point and removing one testing point, all of this manually, then you cannot even go to sleep, right? So you're wasting a lot of time.
I mean, but you need to check periodically if it's improved or not. So what I'm doing is that I'm
collecting... Improvement can be checked programmatically.
Yeah.
It's a bit complicated in terms of implementation.
I think, I mean, given the fact that we want to use this modeling technique, and if this sort of becomes the core part of your thesis, I think it makes a lot of sense for you to spend some time to, you know, write that automation and iron out all the details. Because even for this paper, it seems like you're stuck with one application for 1 week, you know, with the manual process. If you automate this thing, spend 2 days to automate it, then the program will, you know, speed things up much faster than you can spend hours trying to create the right model. And I think also from a scientific standpoint, I mean, if someone were to reproduce what you are trying to do here, it would be extremely difficult. And how do you write about this in the paper? Which is why we had to sort of go through the whole exercise of, you know, trying to figure out the algorithm behind your intuition and your manual process for the previous paper. I think we don't want to sort of, you know, in a future paper, if we, let's say, change the process or change the model a little bit, we have to present a new training procedure. It's going to be much easier if you start thinking in an, you know, about automating this whole thing than to try to do it manually. I understand that, you know, doing it manually gives you some insight. You understand better, okay, what happens. But really, the number of different possibilities that you will have to try out doesn't make it practically feasible for you to continue this manual process. I don't know how you feel about that, but at least, you know, as an outsider observing what you're doing, it seems like that's not the right way.
So, which parts are currently manual? I mean, I'm just trying to understand that how manual the whole process is.
It's a collect training procedure. I mean, because the modeling requires you to have a good training mechanism and to have a training data set. Because how do you choose the training data set? That would in future will give you a better accuracy in terms of prediction of newer data points.
I see. So in that case, when you are training, you run one experiment and then you collect the data. And then you start another experiment manually?
No. That's what I don't know. So thing is that, what I do is that typically I figure out, okay, let's do a whole bunch of experiments, right?
Okay.
With a lot of data sets. Then I collect those data and put it into the model. And to see that if the modeling gives you a good accuracy or not. If the accuracy is not achieved, I start collecting fresh data points again.
No, so initially when you collect, let's say you are collecting 50 data points.
Mm-hmm.
Those 50 data points, you just launch some script. It runs 50 different configurations and it gives you 50 data points.
Exactly.
Okay, and then you collect these 50 and then you feed that into the model.
Yeah.
That's a manual step.
I see. And within these 50, you would choose some training set and then some evaluation set.
Exactly. Let's say 35 are for training and 15 are for after testing.
I see. And how long does it take to run this? Once you have the 50 data points, putting them in the model and then using part of it for training and part for testing, how long this process takes?
About 1 hour.
So that's one candidate model.
One candidate model takes 1 hour to train and test. And you're sitting there on the computer all the time.
Just for 1 hour, not for collecting the data, right?
I know, but that's for one candidate model you're spending
one
hour.
One candidate model.
So how many candidate models have you tried in the last week?
A lot. A whole bunch of. So
if and also the collection of data points is taking time. So I cannot really experience.
How many candidate models do we need? I mean, how many models do we need for all these controls that we have?
So the thing is that you try with 50 data points, let's say, and you see that the accuracy is way, way lower than what you expect, then you collect another 50 points, right? After observing how the behavior is. So you figure out, okay, let's say in CPU benchmark, the cap is of more priority than memory. So you collect taking more data points with different cap value, and then you feed it into the model again. Then you see, okay, you improve a little bit better. So now you try collecting more to see if it gets better or not.
Yeah, it's also number of data points that you can have, the maximum number of data points. So no, there is no limit. There's no limit?
No.
Even though your step size. Right? If your step size is 6, then there is a limit. Right? I'm just trying to figure out what is the total, the maximum amount of time you need to.
It all depends on the benchmark. It could be for CPU benchmark, could be very less, or for memory benchmark, for OLT benchmark, it could be a lot higher.
I think you're asking the number of points.
Number of points, not the time. Number of points is widely variant on the benchmark. Right?
Take the worst possible benchmark, right? And the worst possible number of points, what is that number?
All combinations. For the OLTP, I'm having 270 points.
270, and each point takes like 5 minutes or 15 minutes?
It depends. As I said, for some allocation it could be 2 minutes, for some allocation it could be 20 minutes.
I'm just trying to figure out maybe 1 week is enough to run all combinations, and then you just check that there are points that are...
I think, so for instance, we take, let's say, a 5% CPU step size, 64 megabyte step size for memory, and then you have 7 IO nice values, and you have competing IO ops at 100 IO op granularity. You have a huge number of data points. It's probably
100 IO ops is not there. Probably 1,000.
1,000 IO ops. Even so, I think we are talking about thousands of data points.
Mm.
If we want all the data.
But you don't need actually all those finer granularities. You could have more bigger granularities.
Yeah, it's possible. But I think I'm just going with what Ming is suggesting.
Yeah, in the worst case. Right? Yeah. In the worst case, it could be like that.
Yeah, in the worst case, right? So I don't think that's a practical solution. To run all possible configurations. Yes.
Ajay?
Yeah, I think, first of all, why are we running all possible configurations? I thought that one thing we could do, given the less time, is that when we are running CPU going from 5% to 100% cap, we would keep the memory and IO allocation to be high. And then when we are running the memory, we will keep the CPU and IO allocation to be high. I mean, we don't have to run every possible value in terms of CPU, memory and IO.
I think the problem is that the impact of CPU is going to be different at different memory levels. And when you want to make an actual allocation, you have to look at what is available at that point. So let's say I get 128 megabytes of memory, and I want to find out what would be the impact if I increase CPU by 20%. How can I make that, how can I get an answer to that, right? So that's why we have to create a model where we are sort of having these several combinations.
I see. I think to get better model, you should run all of them.
Yeah. So I was thinking that, I mean, the key here is how to pick the training points.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had an algorithm in that previous paper, I thought, which was reasonably well fleshed out based on your description of the process, right, of how you were doing it for the previous. And I don't know if you changed that for this new study.
No, I'm doing the same thing.
So, I mean, it seems like the instead of you spending time trying to figure out which additional training points you should be collecting, if this whole thing could be automated into a script that says, okay, run my modeling right now and tell me which are the training points to collect. Well, run that, get those training points automatically, and you can of course keep track of the whole thing, what's going on at any given time, right? And why you're collecting certain training points. I think you can save a lot of time that way, because then the whole thing will be going on even while you're sleeping, like I said. So I think it's worth spending some time, and that might actually be that whole, you know, whatever engine you're using to do this dynamic training and testing and creating of the model can be a contribution by itself. In the very least, it seems it can save you a lot of time.
Yeah, so where is this algorithm to figure out which training points to collect?
In the HCCA paper, there is in the evaluation section. There is a flow chart.
Oh, okay. I'll try to find out the paper and try to go through it.
It's in the modeling section, I think. You see a training procedure, something like that, sub.
Oh, flowchart for iterative model training.
Yeah, that's the one. We spend a lot of time discussing that.
I think it's in also your website.
Yeah, no, I can just go there.
But then in this, it says, I guess I would have to read the text, because the diagram, it just says, if the accuracy is not good enough, then identify additional data points to include.
Yeah, exactly. So there are some tunable parameters in there. For instance, if the accuracy change threshold and things like that. But I think, you know, maybe this is not the final thing that we need, right? But at least we reached a point where we could formalize the whole thing, and I think it's worth starting from this point and maybe improving this rather than
trying
to do it manually, because then for each application you have to spend so much time, for each different workload you have to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to use this for your subsequent papers, then this is going to be a very valuable tool for you to have. And even if we change the input parameters, you can still go ahead and use this, right?
Yep.
If you make it generic enough.
So, what is the total number of data points if you multiply all the points for all resources?
That's too much. That's why I'm using modeling, right?
So, no, well, let's come up with a number, right?
Let's come up with a number. Okay, let's say you're varying cap from 5 to 60. That means 12 points.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
12 points. If you are varying memory from, let's say, 128 to 1024 at 64 megs granularity?
I think 128 is too tiny, but maybe...
256?
Yeah, you can start with even 256.
So, yeah, that could be maybe...
Most of the OSs, they don't even boot properly on 128.
Yeah, 256 up to 2 gigabytes or 4 gigabytes maybe at that. That would be around 8 steps.
Let's say 256 to, in our set of type of benchmarks, is 1 gig.
Mm-hmm.
1 gig.
Okay.
Because it doesn't affect after you go ahead.
After 1 gig,
after
it
doesn't
make
any difference.
120, so that's about 4 steps?
That's about 8.
So if you go 128 MB each, then that's 6 steps.
Yeah, 6 steps. Okay, so
first, which one is feasible, 64 or 128?
Probably.
I mean, let's start with 128. My whole point is, we can always start with a higher granularity, and then missing points we would get if there is a need.
Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say 6 points there, and then we have ionize, which has, I don't know, how many values do we have?
8 values.
8 values.
We can just pick 3. That's something. That's what I'm doing.
Okay, pick 3.
I mean, let's pick all 8 for the time being. Then
okay.
How many data points do we have? 12 into 6 into 8.
And then we have one more parameter, which is the competing IOPS.
There could be 6 range, possibly.
6 possible values?
Yeah, I'm saying, let's starting from 100 to 6,000, 1,000 IOPS generating.
Yeah, so, yeah, times 6 again then.
Times 6 again.
I see. I guess this becomes roughly 3,000.
Yeah.
So if we start pruning now, let's say ionize instead of 8, we go 4.
Yeah.
And the CPU, you are saying 12 is fine, I think. 12 into 6 into 4.
12 is actually much more. I mean, we could do it to 6, actually.
Yeah. Even then, we probably end up with 500
points.
And the coarse granularity. And to increase accuracy, we'll have to explore some parts of the space that are more finer grained, perhaps.
Yeah. Within the 500 points.
So 500 points, how long does it take to collect 500 points? If you run these 500 points in a script and say that change numbers and then restart the experiment, then do we have an estimate on how long would it take?
Each point may take average, because I'm taking the average of each run and doing it 3 times for each point.
Hmm.
So,
I see. And how long is each run?
It's 15 minutes, average.
I see. So let's say, so you're doing 3 runs at each point?
3 runs at each point.
Okay, and then what do you pick as the final output once you do 3 runs?
Median of it.
Median of it, okay. So I think that basically means you are running roughly 1 hour on each experiment. And 500 experiments roughly means 500 hours.
Yeah.
Because you'll have to have some warm-up time and things like that in between.
Yeah.
So 500 hours is how many days? That's actually quite a bit. That's roughly 2 weeks.
That's what ideally I should do, but that's why I'm reducing the number of data collection. Try to see, I mean, if we can do
more coarse grain.
More coarse grain, but also achieving the accuracy at the same time.
Yeah. So you have to go coarser than that, and then be very careful as to which parts you explore further at a finer grain. Yeah, sounds like we should probably
I would assume it should be like some tree-based approach where you start with CPU in units of 10% and then you can fill in the remaining points later on. And similarly, for every resource, you can start at a higher granularity and then the middle point you can do at the next level once you have time.
And the other thing is that, I mean, what happens to this in an online case, right? I mean, if you have to learn this in an online fashion, is it realistic to expect to have so many data points? I think there the question of, well, what can you do with a subset of this data? Can you, let's say you have only a subset of this entire range for each resource, then can you do good predictions if you're trying to predict in that subset, right? And I think that's a question as well for us to think about for the future.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem, as you mentioned, is that you won't get a good range.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a lot of data points clustered within a small range.
Right.
And now the modeling won't work very well because you don't have a good range of data points to come up with it.
Yeah, I guess the question is, the model accuracy depends on the testing points as well, right? So if you have to predict in the ranges that you're observing, then maybe your accuracy will still be good. But if you go outside the training data ranges, then maybe your accuracy goes down. So depends on how that model is going to be used.
So the thing is that in my modeling, I can come up with some data points which could really good show you with a lot of random data points, which could really tell you that the model is really accurate.
Mm.
So, but it's not the whole story.
Mm. So you have to pick the training data at random, really at random.
Training data at more uniform way, but testing data also, what testing data you choose?
Sorry, testing data, I meant.
It plays a lot on your accuracy.
Yeah.
Yes, I think for the first version, I would say let's not worry about getting stuff online. Because I think even if we showcase that here is a good approach, that if you take your workload, you run a different you run it with different configurations and you let the modeler create it, even then I think it's a useful contribution.
Yeah.
Going online is, I think, opening another can of worms that we should not do at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And that was our strategy for now, which is ignore the harder problem for the time being and at least try to solve the easier problem.
True, and what you are calling an easier problem itself, I think, is a pretty hard problem.
Yeah, relatively.
Relatively, it is easier.
Yeah. So, I don't know, I feel, Sajib, that, you know, it's worth spending time trying to automate this process. Because even though the data collection phase is the more time-consuming phase, you're also spending substantial amount of time doing the whole model training, right? And if you were to automate this, maybe you can start with more coarser grain and have the automator figure out how to get the final grain. Then you trying to figure this out manually, it may be harder. Because there are so many dimensions, and then, well, you're lost in four dimensions. But if you automate this thing...
Yeah, actually, four dimensions is very hard. That's the problem with the OLTP. It's more complex.
Yeah. So... I still think that it's worth spending more time trying to get this automated. It's not going to be, you know,
but
easy.
But with
I
manual, I mean, you have the more confidence of giving it, of giving more accuracy. Because you can easily see, I mean, if you put the data on the Excel sheet,
mm-hmm.
you can easily figure out okay, which is the missing point.
Right, but can't you automate that thing? Because, I mean, for you, if you're figuring it out, you're using some mechanism to figure it out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you can still automate whatever it is that you're doing. It requires a little bit of work, but think about, you know, future use of whatever it is that you're creating right now. And, you know, that should motivate you to do this, you know, automation.
Yeah, everything is programmable, right?
Mm. I mean, if you have a, you know,
yeah,
determined...
Human
I mean,
mind is not programmable. I don't
what? Word is not programmable?
Human mind is not programmable.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, that's a different discussion. We're not talking about
so that's
that.
That's an employee to find out.
Yeah.
No, that's what we are trying to achieve eventually. So it's a good stepping stone.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a separate procedure, I mean, to come up with the training. That would go besides what I'm doing.
Yeah. Oh.
The training mechanism, the automating the training mechanism.
Yeah.
It's a little hard.
Yeah. But then you can sort of merge these two, right? So using the training mechanism as a step in your automatic data collection and final model.
Then figuring out what needs to be done to improve further, right? That's
yeah.
what I'm saying.
So you start, you know, you write a full program which is going to create the model. Internally, it's going to have things like, okay, I'm going to collect an additional data point, I'm going to check accuracy, and then it will...
What you're saying that you can always come back later and improve the accuracy manually, but if you need to.
No, I'm trying to take the manual out of the
okay.
equation, right? So your goal is to have a program which goes and automatically collects data and automatically builds a good model.
Okay.
Right? So that program will start with some user input. Maybe you'll say that, okay, that my input parameters for various controls are in this range. Maybe you can also hint that, well, actually, no, I think even that should be automated. So this program should figure out, okay, what are the output ranges? So by giving the least amount of resource in each dimension and giving the maximum amount of resource in each dimension, you can sort of see the range of output values that this application can produce,
yeah.
right? And then you're... I think the goal that we used in the previous training procedure was, well, how do we fill up the entire output range
in a proper
in a uniform way so that
yeah.
we cover the entire output range. Now, so you have to then figure out, okay, let me start by going with very coarse grain to see how the output ranges get filled up. And then for certain points, the output range gaps are higher, so let me explore those parameter values a little bit more deeply. And so do those. At each step, you can, for instance, choose some random testing points, collect data for those testing points, run it against the model that you have so far, and see how is the accuracy. And if the accuracy is not good, well, I need to go and further explore the missing output ranges by collecting more data to fill those gaps. Right? I think it can be automated. Because it seems like that's what you're doing manually.
Yeah.
And that's what we describe in the paper as well. So, I mean, since you wrote it in the paper, you should be implementing it and using it, right?
Since you only believe your gut, you don't believe what you
Yeah. So I think it's possible.
Guys, I think I'll have to drop off. I have actually a meeting at 11:30 that I have to go to.
Yeah, sure. I think we are close to done. And
okay. And if someone is taking any minutes or any action items, feel free to send them.
Yeah, actually, okay. Yeah. So we record all our meetings audio. I'll send you a pointer to that. All the previous meetings are also recorded voice.
Oh wow.
Okay.
Interesting.
So just, I mean, it helps when we write papers or we write code and things like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, I'll drop off.
All right. Thanks, Ajay.
Sure. Bye.
Bye. Are there any other suggestions? I mean, my suggestion is to go after this automation right now. And, I mean, OSTI is out of the question, right? That's not going to happen. What may happen is middleware. So we should, I think, try to push it. Push for it.
It's very close now.
Yeah.
Even middleware, it's not just crunch. So
like, yeah. And the other thing is that, I mean, you're off to VMware.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sort of drop this, you coming back to this work after 3 months is going to be painful. So you have to find time to work on it, despite being...
I'll probably try to catch up with Ajay to find some time for my work.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying is that you might have to work weekends for the next few weekends so that you wrap this up, because you'll really, you know, thank yourself for having done that, because many of your future weekends will be freed up if you do it right now. Because it's always harder to come back to a project, right? After a long gap, oh, where are all my Excel sheets? Where is all my data? And you had to spend a lot of time just, you know, getting to the stage where you were at that point. So,
when are you leaving?
Next Sunday. This Sunday.
So, and yeah, I mean, you've spent so much time this whole semester on this work, right? So it's really, you know, important for you to wrap it up, continue work and wrap this up.
Yeah.
I mean, towards the end of the summer, you can take it more easy, you know, explore California and all that.
Right? No problem. Think of more.
No, I mean, I would also want to explore California. It's a new state. I'm going to a new place. I want to, you know, go out during the weekends. But I think, I mean, if you think about long term, it's really important for you to, you know, get this done. To make sure that, you know, you graduate at the right time, you know, with your PhD, right?
Mm.
Because otherwise, yeah. if these keep getting postponed, it can snowball into delays, right?
Maybe you can bring your workstation with you. You can take experiments in the summer.
Take the computer?
Yeah. I'm just all you get to experiment.
I think you can do it remotely.
Yeah,
it's
remotely.
Because
yeah.
Your virtual machines don't crash.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, so you should be able to do this remotely. And I think in the meanwhile, based on our discussion today, the motivation and context can be fleshed out better in the introduction.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe Kaushik or Ming, one of you guys can sort of try to rewrite the context and background and introduction.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll try to rewrite the story.
The
story needs to be rewritten.
Yeah, and also, yeah, I think we had a really good discussion.
Where is the due date for middleware?
Middleware is, I think, 23rd of this month. But we have, I think, to submit abstract on 15th or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, let's say, 20 days away.
Yeah, yeah, but the theory away, so it's going to be tough.
But, I mean, if you can automate it in the next few days, then you don't really have to be there for all the model creation and everything, right? I mean, you don't have to be manually present and trying to train the
part
model.
Of the work is still at a more nascent state. So that's, I mean, the implementation is more or less done, but to try out, I'm sure if we try out with big data sets, there would be some errors or something that may come up.
It's possible, but we have, I think, push for it regardless.
Yeah.
I think if we have to think positively.
My strategy is to just finish with the modeling as quickly as possible. That's the most complicated part and time consuming part.
Yeah.
So, but after that, that could be expedited.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I haven't anticipated actually because it takes so much time. Because the problem comes that Kaushik mentioned is that in HPC paper we try with small ranges. When you go to the bigger set, it takes a lot more time.
Yeah, but that's the more realistic case, right? I mean, the smaller ranges are not the not.
So
the
I'm also thinking
one.
That is the accuracy what we achieved in the HPC paper, is that really feasible in the long range of data? It may not be feasible.
May not be feasible, but the real question is that for this sort of a model, which is, you know, a software as a service or whatever private cloud model, maybe that much accuracy is not required. So you can sort of have your QoS provisioning decision account for that inaccuracy. Let's say my predictions are going to be inaccurate by 20%. And that's okay, because then I can say, okay, my expected performance can be 20% lower
or higher,
and then I'm going to provision based on that, you know, taking that inaccuracy into account. It's still possible, right? So I think having a goal of getting a certain amount of accuracy is not the right approach, because it may not even be possible. If you were to create that automated training procedure, that will give you, you know, this information in a more concrete way. If you keep doing it manually, you don't know what you're missing. Right? You say, oh, let me try this other thing, and in the end, you don't know whether you've tried everything or not. But if you build an automator that's going to explore systematically, then I think you'll have an easier time. I'm thinking in four dimensions, not easy. For a person, but it's easy for a computer, right? So yeah, you have to, I think, move towards automation. I would. but that's just me. Okay, so then what are we doing next week? Are we meeting?
Next week I'll be away.
I know you'll be away.
On Thursday.
So next,
I think we should for Sajid's interest, I think we should keep at least meeting, even if he's in California. We should have a teleconference call or something like that.
Yeah.
On the first day, I don't think it's good, because I'm joining on the 10th, so maybe two.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm not saying immediately, but at least throughout the summer, if you have that, otherwise he'll be out of loop. And
probably I will try to catch up with Ajay and have the meeting with him.
Well, we need to have a meeting offline this week, right? Maybe on Thursday or Friday.
Thursday, I'm meeting with you.
Yeah. And then we can maybe meet on Tuesday next week with everyone.
Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's important for you to have this meeting continued throughout the summer.
There is a free conference line, actually, teleconference line.
There is a free teleconference line?
Yes.
I think Kaushik pointed
out.
But
you can meet with Ajay, right?
Yeah.
I can meet with Ajay.
You mean offline?
No. In the meeting. I mean,
Oh, I see. You can go to Ajay's office.
Yeah.
Sure. I think that's fine. We can always do this. This is a telecon, by the way, right? So what you're saying is that if we don't need a physical location to host this. Is that what?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I see.
If I don't know what Sajid's schedule will be, if he's busy during the daytime for his favorite things, then we can have the meeting on Saturday or in the early morning.
better I can just have it on my cell phone, sir.
Yeah, from his home, basically. And
or we could do Skype. If everyone is using Skype, we can use Skype.
Skype is excellent also. So there are a lot of technical options.
Okay, all right, let's do that. Okay, good. So, we'll meet next Tuesday. I'll meet with Sajib offline
morning.
And we'll set up a time for Tuesday.
They have a capacity planning. The whole project is about the capacity planning, planning problem. Is to figure out what the customer needs based on some trial run in terms of how much resources it needs to meet its performance or something. So that's the whole
provisioning.
And the problem set is the parameter set is a lot larger.
Is that what Arches Group is doing?
No.
I think it's
more into
IO.
Right? IO.
Okay.
But this is a set joint.
It's a very good opportunity.
It's very relevant what they are doing.
Good. All right. So, what else, Sajib?
I don't know. I haven't anticipated this time much.
Yeah. Well, you really
It's a cumbersome and most the boring process.
I know. That's why you have to use the computer. You have a computer, you should use it. It's really. You should start trusting computers more. Okay.
So we'll meet
on Thursday. What time? Do we have a time?
Afternoon, probably.
Afternoon. Afternoon. Sounds good. Afternoon.
3 or 4.
Yeah. 3 p.m. 3 p.m.
So are you going to summer to India this time?
I don't have any plans so far.
Okay.